It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Sponsors of and supporters for gun control legislation, including the proposals being considered by Pittsburgh City Council, consistently say the efforts are intended to curb violence. But might there be an unintended consequence in African-American communities? This evening from 6 to 9 o'clock at the Ace Hotel in East Liberty, the national news group City Lab is hosting a community conversation on what policies actually work to protect African-Americans, women, the LGBTQ community, and the religious community. Joining us to talk about this, two panelists from tonight's event, Marita Garrett, the mayor of Wilkinsburg, and Brenton Mock, writer-reporter for City Lab. Welcome to the Confluence. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Good morning. Thanks for having us on.
So when you hear lawmakers at the city or the state level, when you hear Mayor Peduto say these proposed ordinances are meant to reduce violence, make the city safer, make the state safer, how do you react? Marita, we'll start with you.
Okay. Yeah, so I think there's a lot of things. That's, you know, kind of a loaded question. And in the protections and legislation that the City Council and Mayor Peduto are proposing, it reduces gun violence in some ways. But when we talk about gun violence, as we know, there's so many different components in that. So, yes, you can restrict use of certain guns, but we also have to get at the root of the problem of gun violence, especially how it is plaguing and affecting Black communities.
Brent?
Yeah, I mean, first we should obviously, you know, give respect to the people who were murdered at the tragic Tree of Life shootings last year. I mean, that was something that really shell-shocked Pittsburgh. But at the same time, I think Pittsburgh was still in many neighborhoods reeling from gun violence in several neighborhoods. I mean, one of the most high-profile shootings was the shooting of rapper Jimmy Wapo in the Hill District. A few years before that in Wilkinsburg, obviously, mm-hmm. there was a terrible shooting. And several people killed in a backyard shooting. And so, you know, these are the kinds of things where I think a lot of African-Americans around the city of Wilkinsburg and Pittsburgh are, you know, they're reaching out for answers. You know, how can we make our homes, our schools, our workplaces, the streets safer for us to go around? And whether these ordinances go far enough, you know, that remains to be seen. But I think we all probably agree that it's an imperative that the city try to do something about this.
Right. So do something. But how do you address what are the root causes? What do you see as the root causes of the violence?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a public health epidemic. So when we start talking about public health epidemics, we start, you know, we need to assess mental health. What is the environments of which people are growing up in? What is the socioeconomic status? How are all of these things linked? And I believe, especially in Allegheny County, there's a lot of correlations between, you know, the neighborhoods people are growing up in based on the quality of education or lack thereof. And we have to really look at those things as to who's being really providing equitable quality of life and who's not. And then we can begin to discuss, you know, more of these components.
Do we look at the sort of the interrelationships of all those things, whether it's employment, whether it's education, you mentioned public health, and then or we just try to separate gun violence from all of those? Brenton?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously the issues of education and poverty and it also, you know, racism and segregation, all of these things play a role into, you know, how people access guns, how people access health care, trauma care when they're shot, who gets that, who doesn't. So another thing that's at the root of this is the distribution of resources across the region. So not just in Pittsburgh, but to cities like Wilkinsburg mm-hmm. and also cities like East Pittsburgh, where we had the young African-American teenager Antoine Rose, who was killed by a police officer. I mean, all of these things have to be talked about in an intersectional way and not just individually.
Maria?
Absolutely. I mean, when we look at it, as Brenton touched base on, the Tree of Life, when it happened, we had a really rough summer. You know, I saw increases, or we all saw increases of county homicides and shootings. In Wilkinsburg, we increased over the summer as some of our neighboring communities did. So that was just even more added to a violent year that we've all been experiencing. And we've seen hate here in Pittsburgh before, in this region before. As we mentioned, the Wilkinsburg Massacre, shooting at Monroeville Mall, shootings here, shootings there. So it's not an isolated event. So something absolutely does need to be done, but we need to make sure in those actions we're taking that there aren't populations being left out of that narrative.
In recent years, the numbers show that 3 out of 4 homicide victims in the city are African American. Those numbers, I mean, it's usually about that, maybe a little higher, maybe just a little lower. So is there a perception? And I realize that perception can be that person's reality that, well, I'm not being protected. I might need a weapon. I might need a legally purchased gun to protect myself. What are you hearing?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, that when you talk to African Americans, you know, gun control itself, that term can raise a lot of anxiety, because if you live in a neighborhood where African Americans are perpetually being the victim of any kind of violence, you know, whether it's gun violence or property crime violence, people breaking into your house, people breaking into your car, you know, you want to be able to defend yourself. You want to be able to defend your family. We also should definitely not take lightly the climate, the political climate that we live in. We know that the Tree of Life shooting was a, you know, a hate exacerbated crime, that this was a person who came in from outside of Pittsburgh with the intention to harm and kill based off of racist and white nationalists and white supremacist feelings. All of these things that are happening nationally, whether it's Charlottesville or the kinds of like neo-Nazi rallies we're seeing around, we obviously, Pittsburgh is not immune to that. The Southern Poverty Law Center cites that there are several hate groups in Western Pennsylvania, one of which is very close to Pittsburgh. I remember just recently there was a, there almost was that alt-right rally near the Google headquarters, right down the street from you. So Pittsburgh's not immune to this. And if it, you know, if that kind of like dealing with the issues of white supremacy and racism aren't dealt with, then yes, and you know, African Americans will continue to feel, you know, vulnerable to being victimized by that kind of violence.
And Marita, you know, Wilkinsburg, the neighboring community to the city, that hate, those feelings, that racism, it doesn't stop at a city border. So what are you experiencing? What are you sensing in your community of Wilkinsburg?
Yeah, we're sensing, because it trickles down from the national level, but we are sensing, you know, worry, concern, just because we can protect ourselves within Wilkinsburg. And, you know, I believe our community is great and we have great community pride. But look what happens. It's not community members that are necessarily shooting up one another and doing the crimes. It's people who are coming from outside based on whatever sexist, racist, homophobic, xenophobic views that they have. So you do become worried, because right now on the federal government, there's this level of fear. Everything that all the actions, all these legislative things are being passed in fear. And whenever you're reacting to fear, it's never going to be great. So we need to make sure, as much as I can do, working with our public safety department, specifically the police department, on ways that maybe we can mitigate some of these things, ways to have citizens be more active in their safety. And if we are talking about guns, being kind of what your article said, being proactive in gun safety. If you are going to protect yourself, which we all should really have the right to, being aware and well equipped to do so responsibly.
The article that Murdy is referring to is Brenton's story most recently at CityLab. And where can they find that, Brenton?
CityLab.com.
Yes. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're talking with Marita Garrett, the mayor of Wilkinsburg, and Brenton Mock, writer-reporter for City Lab. City Lab this evening is hosting a community conversation on what policies actually work to protect African Americans, women, the LGBTQ community, and the religious community. You've both referenced Tree of Life synagogue massacre back in October. The proposed ordinances that City Council is considering, they were introduced a couple of months after the Tree of Life shootings. That evoked so many emotions, sadness, grief, even anger. But there was criticism that the community response was so much greater than the compounded loss of many Black lives almost day after day. Are you hearing that? It's, you know, it's a lot of losses, but it's even more losses when you compound all those individual deaths. Are you hearing that?
Seeing it too, hearing and seeing. I mean, you know, a tragedy is a tragedy everywhere. So every life that we lose is unfortunate and unnecessary due to gun violence. So when you see the rallying support, as we should, that, you know, Tree of Life is an example of how we should come together for all situations and outcomes of gun violence.
All the emphasis on all, Brenton.
Exactly. And again, this is a thing that really deserves kind of region-wide attention, right? I mean, like, what happens in Homewood affects what happens in Wilkinsburg, which affects what happens in Swissville, which happens affects what happens in Homestead, mm-hmm. and the city of Pittsburgh. You know, people don't just stay, like, on their street. You know, they travel, they go across neighborhoods. And, you know, while we're really glad to see city of Pittsburgh take a first step towards addressing this, there still needs to kind of be an acknowledgement that all of the municipalities around Allegheny County, there needs to be a kind of shared information, shared communication, and shared resources so that all of these neighborhoods can address gun violence in a holistic and thorough way, not just kind of a piecemeal fashion.
Marita, you weren't mayor at the time, but Wilkinsburg suffered its own mass shooting just 3 years ago, this mm-hmm. past weekend, I believe it was. Five people and an unborn child. Do you hear any echoes of that loss in what happened at Squirrel Hill? Yeah, that mass shooting in your community a few years ago.
No. And, you know, one of the things is, and I think that was what was interesting, is that it was perceived that this was the first hate crime that our region had experienced. And, you know, as you just said, that was just 3 years. Well, when Tree of Life happened, it's about 2.5 years ago, the massacre in Wilkinsburg. And we just came off of the killing of Antoine Rose back in June. So to me, it was still reeling from the hurt of this. And then you add that on. But I think what kind of puts more salt in that wound is seeing how different communities are treated in response to that. You know, when the massacre at Wilkinsburg happened, we didn't get a call or, you know, an offer, hey, we'll come guard your communities 24/7. They did not raise, you know, over $1 million, $2 million. And this is a woman, the mother who was the matriarch, who lost about four of her family members. Mm.
We should note that we referenced the bills in city council do not ban guns. They do not take away guns. Brenton, your report say that these ordinances or proposed ordinances are fairly lenient and in line with what many other cities have tried. So how might they have unintended consequences?
Several ways. One is, obviously, there's always the specter of overcriminalization of African Americans. If you're going to create a gun ordinance, gun control ordinance, where you're saying that no one can ever have a gun out in public, you know, obviously that kind of sets up a pretext for you to really be, you know, for police to racially profile African Americans who they think might have guns. Which could lead to the over-criminalization and over-incarceration and over-arresting of African-Americans. And I spoke with Mayor Peduto about that, and he seemed to be very confident that he and the fellow city council members, Corey O'Connor and Erica Strasburger, that they would be able to add amendments to these ordinances to ensure that kind of disproportionate policing would not happen.
All right. The event hosted by City Lab this evening will focus on gun control in marginalized communities, but you'll also address other populations who are often targeted, women, members of the queer community, and others. So how are you digging into this issue?
I think it's a fair question of whether it is if it is even possible for these kinds of communities to experience true safety. In urban environments. And I think the kind of questions that we're wrestling with, how do you insert racial equity? How do you insert gender equity? And consider all of these kinds of implications when implementing these policies. That should be kind of the driving discourse for this, because obviously if passed recklessly, then you very well could lead Jewish communities, queer communities, Black communities more vulnerable to gun violence.
Does it start with policy, or is it more on us, the average citizen, the people, especially the privileged among us to say no more, and no more for all communities?
I think it's a mixture of both. I think you need those people, you need those citizens, especially those who are coming from more of a place of privilege, to work with the policymakers to enact these and pass these laws responsibly.
Brenton?
Yeah, and it also, again, I can't emphasize enough, it takes the rallying of jurisdictions across the county and across the state, people to kind of wake up and realize that the way that we're handling and selling and purchasing and utilizing guns are creating these public health epidemics. We have to remind ourselves that most of the guns that come through Wilkinsburg and Pittsburgh are not purchased in Wilkinsburg and Pittsburgh. It's not even a place to buy them in these cities. So we have to kind of address the fact that these surrounding municipalities and jurisdictions have to kind of pull their weight and realize that, you know, that they are a part of this gun epidemic that we're all suffering from.
Brenton Mock is a writer, reporter for City Lab. Marita Garrett is the mayor of Wilkinsburg. This evening from 6 to 9 o'clock at the Ace Hotel in East Liberty, City Lab is hosting a community conversation, what it means to be protected in urban spaces. The event is free and open to the public. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for
Thank
having
you.
Me.
Thank you. Yes, absolutely.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence. 40 years ago this month, a partial meltdown at the Three Mile Island nuclear plant resulted in mass evacuations, but also in breakthroughs and new tasks for robots cleaning up the mess. And what is the color of water? It's not a trick question, but something researchers are getting excited about after newly published work shows some clear droplets can cast brilliant iridescent color. This could help in the development of everything from cosmetics to bacteria detection in public water supplies. Coming up, we'll take a look at structural color. Get conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence at wesa.fm/confluence.
I'm Julia Zankovich with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, the Pittsburgh Courier begins publication in 1910. Initially established in 1907, the newspaper gained national prominence after attorney Robert Lee Vann took over. By the 1930s, it was one of the top-selling newspapers for African Americans, and eventually one of the first to publish both national and local editions. The paper called for improvements for African Americans in areas such as housing, education, and healthcare, and protested misrepresentations of African Americans in the media. Today, the Pittsburgh Courier is published as the New Pittsburgh Courier. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The partial meltdown of one of Three Mile Island's nuclear reactors 40 years ago this month left areas of the facility highly radioactive. Along came a group of young researchers with an idea to send in robots to fix the damage. For State Impact Pennsylvania, 90.5 WESA's Amy Sisk reports that their work helped expand the fledgling field of robotics.
Ooh, boy, look at this.
Red Whitaker calls me over to his computer at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh.
This is really old. I haven't looked at any of it in eternity.
He shows me video footage his robot took of the basement at Three Mile Island's Unit 2 containment building.
They could see for the first time the accumulation of hundreds of thousands of gallons of contaminated water that had filled up like a bathtub to a height of about 8 feet.
The nation's worst commercial nuclear accident prompted tens of thousands of people near the Dauphin County reactor to evacuate in March 1979. In the years following, Mike Pavlik helped oversee cleanup.
We were not going to be able to put human beings in there because of the risk. So we decided that we needed robots to do some of that work.
The thing is, robots had never been used in that way.
It was brand new in the nuclear business. Robots were used primarily in repetitive operations.
Like in auto factories to weld together parts of cars. This is where Whitaker's expertise came in.
I was looking for that opportunity to contribute, and I was looking for that iconic robotic development project that would put the technology on the map.
He enlisted the help of those around him, mainly undergraduate students. John Bears was just a sophomore.
We had a dream and a few pieces of paper and convinced them that we could solve the problem.
Whitaker's younger brother, Chuck, wanted to join too. He worked as an engineer for a coal company.
I would come over on the weekends, and I would come over on my vacation days and work, because it was fun.
In 1983, a crane lowered their first robot into the basement of the containment building. The machine had six wheels and special cameras that could withstand radiation, as well as numerous seals to keep out water. A second robot soon followed. It could drill into concrete and remove wall samples for analysis. Bears says their third robot was never used.
We tried to make it a Swiss Army knife that would do all kinds of things.
It could drill and lift items and move them around, but Bears says it wasn't reliable. Yet, it led to more robots down the road. Chuck Whitaker walks me through a hallway at CMU to a timeline showing all the field robots developed at the university since the Three Mile Island days.
That was the first Mine 1. This was the first navigational laboratory. That was our first autonomous driving vehicle.
The Whitakers both work as researchers at CMU today. Bears recently led Uber's autonomous vehicle program, and he now heads a robotics company in Pittsburgh. The brothers recently developed a robot to help decommission uranium enrichment facilities. Red Whitaker shows me a prototype. It crawls through pipelines in search of residual uranium and sends out sound waves.
It uses that as part of its calculation to determine exactly where it is.
Chuck Whitaker says the robot will save time and money and prevent exposure to humans who would otherwise have to do the work.
That's really the value, when you can reduce the hazards to the personnel.
That's why the robots went in to Three Mile Island. Soon, more could go back. TMI is scheduled to close this fall unless the state intervenes. Robots could be part of its decommissioning. Red Whitaker doesn't know if he would be involved, but...
I gotta say, I would absolutely love to revisit TMI.
To finish a job he helped start nearly four decades ago. Amy Sisk, 90.5 WESA News.
State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among WESA, WHYY, WITF, and the Allegheny Front, covering the Commonwealth's energy economy. It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In 1948, a white Pittsburgh Post-Gazette reporter named Ray Spriggle disguised himself as an African-American and traveled south to learn about life under Jim Crow. Pittsburgh-based author Bill Steigerwald researched the project for his book, 30 Days a Black Man. 90.5 WESA's Bill O'Driscoll spoke with Steigerwald. The audio degrades briefly about 2 minutes into this interview.
Who was Ray Spriggle?
Ray Spriggle was Pittsburgh's greatest journalist, newspaper man. From about 1911 to 1957, he worked for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. He was famous for his undercover work. He would disguise himself as various things, such as a mental patient in the state mental hospitals, as a coal miner, as a black market meat salesman in World War II, and then write six, seven-part series in the Post-Gazette, highly publicized, highly touted front-page stories. By the time 1948 came around, when he went undercover into the Jim Crow South, disguised as a black man.
The horrors of the Jim Crow South were pretty well documented. Did white folks, Northerners, really not know what was going on down there that Ray Spriggle had to go do this project?
I don't think they did. The average reader of the Post-Gazette, there were 300,000 subscribers. The average reader would have read virtually nothing in the pages of the Post-Gazette about the Jim Crow South, about trials, about lynchings, about whatever horrible things that were going on down there. Whereas blacks in Pittsburgh and throughout the country would have been reading in-depth opinion pieces almost about that kind of news in the Pittsburgh Courier, which was then the largest and arguably the most influential black newspaper in the country. And so if you are a white guy living in Mount Lebanon, and if you're the most liberal person on the planet, you could be reading the Post-Gazette every day faithfully, and you're going to find out very, very little about the South. Blacks in the South, and blacks on the Hill.
What most shocked Spriggle when he went undercover as a black man in the South?
It was the day-to-day sort of threat that hung over everyone, whether you were a professor at Spelman College or whether you were a sharecropper, you were always, if you were black, you were always a little worried about what might happen. Blacks were everywhere and in the society, but they were always at the mercy of the nearest white man.
This is 1948. It's before people really had TVs, certainly before the internet, anything like that. How was Spriggle's story received, the series?
The impact here was enormous. He would sell 20, 30,000 copies of paper. When he did one of his series, the Post-Gazette in those days really knew how to promote. And they promoted the heck out of this thing. It was also syndicated to about 15 papers around the country, from Philadelphia Inquirer to Seattle Times. It was also carried by the Pittsburgh Courier on its front page for 7 straight weeks. The Courier had 400,000 people across the country, editions in 13 cities or so. It was the only way blacks in the South could actually read Spriggle's series, which was 21 parts. And Time magazine wrote up a big story about Spriggle with his picture of him in disguise. And he had the whole country for about 2 or 3 months talking about the issue of ending legal segregation for the first time.
That was 90.5 WESA's Bill O'Driscoll talking with Bill Steigerwald about his nonfiction book, 30 Days a Black Man. The book is now out in paperback. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
WYEP celebrates Women's History Month throughout March. Today, find out about Kathleen Edwards. As the daughter of a Canadian diplomat, Kathleen Edwards spent her youth traveling and living abroad. She started her music career instead of going to college. After years of touring, Edwards released her rock and country debut, Baylor, in 2003. One more song, radio, in 2011, Edwards divorced her longtime collaborator, Colin Cripps, and released a very personal record called Voyager, produced with Justin Vernon of Bon Iver. The album cracked the U.S. Billboard Top 40 in 2012. In 2014, Kathleen Edwards took a break from the music industry and opened Quitter's Cafe near Toronto. In early 2019, she returned to the music business. To hear full songs from all of our featured artists for Women's History Month, go to WYEP.org/women.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. What's the color of water? In its pristine state, it's clear, right? Well, maybe not. Research published recently in the journal Nature explains how some clear droplets of water can produce brilliant iridescent color due to structural color. This is the work of a team of researchers at Penn State University and MIT. Lauren Zarzar is an assistant professor of chemistry at Penn State and a leader of the research team, and she's on the line from Penn State. Welcome to The Confluence, Lauren.
Thank you.
Well, let's start with, what is structural color?
So structural color comes from light that interferes as a result of how the light interacts with the nano to microscale structure of a material. So a great example of a material that has structural color would be opal. Mm. So we're all familiar with, you know, opal rings, and you look at them from different angles and you see these different colors. So that would be called iridescence, and that's very typical of structurally colored materials. And this is different from something like a dye, which is typically how you, for instance, your clothing is dyed with specific pigments and molecules. So it looks the same color from every angle, but structural color is characterized by this iridescence, where because of the light interference, you get these very different colors based on the different angles that you look at it.
And you mentioned opals. Do we also see a similar effect in even living creatures such as butterfly wings?
Definitely. Yes. Many animals use structural color. Peacock feathers are another great example. A lot of different beetles have structural color as well.
You mentioned dyes or pigments. Were you looking, when you started this research, to come up with an alternative or not?
We weren't. This was actually a pretty accidental discovery where we were, you know, working with these liquid droplets and happened to notice that they had this very unusual coloration that we didn't expect. And that's what caused us to dive a little bit deeper and try to figure out what was causing it.
You mentioned accidental. Let me follow up there. So what were you hoping to learn then?
Well, we were looking at these droplets as a way of using them for tunable lenses. So we were interested in the optical properties of the droplets. We just didn't expect them to have this color.
How do you detect the color in what are clear droplets of water?
So we initially just saw this by eye. It's very striking. You don't need any special equipment to see it. We just use a white LED and just illuminate the surface with that, and the color is macroscopically visible to the naked eye.
Are there similarities in the colors of these liquid droplets and rainbows?
The mechanism for the way the light is, the colors are generated is actually quite different from how a rainbow works. Admittedly, when we first saw these colors, we first thought, well, maybe it is the same mechanism by which a rainbow is generated. Rainbow colors, as well as the light colored from a prism,
right,
is generated by a combination of refraction and dispersion. And so that's actually what we thought it might have been initially. But after modeling the system with our collaborators from MIT, we quickly realized that the mechanism that generates the atmospheric rainbow cannot account for the colors that we see from these tiny droplets.
All right. You mentioned tiny droplets. You mentioned they're on a surface. Do they all have to be the same size, the same shape even?
So the color comes from each individual droplet. If you have droplets that are of all different shape or all different size, then each of them will be reflecting a slightly different color or color pattern. And so when you look at hundreds or thousands of these together, the macroscopic effect would be that it looks glittery, whitish. Now, if they're all the same size and the same shape, they all reflect the same colors. And so that's how you can see this macroscopic effect of the very bright colors that you see.
This is radio, so you got to give us a picture. What are the colors you've been seeing?
You can pretty much get any colors. It actually kind of looks like a rainbow in the sense that as you look at the materials at different angles, you see the reds, the greens, the blues. For sort of different shapes, you might be able to see combinations of these. You can see pinks and sort of neon colors that almost look like from a combination of multiple colors. Something that's worth mentioning is this is something that pretty much anybody can sort of do in their kitchen if you want to actually see these things for yourself, because it really is just water condensed onto a clear surface. And I actually wouldn't be surprised if many people know what I'm talking about when you put like saran wrap over warm food and you see the water condense on the underside of the plastic wrap. And as the droplets grow, you see these sparkly colors. So that's really what this effect is. We were just able to control the size of the droplets a lot more precisely. That sort of gives you a more uniform color.
Sounds like a good home experiment with kids.
Yes, definitely.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. Our guest is Lauren Zarzar, Assistant Professor of Chemistry at Penn State and a leader of a research team that has discovered and reported on colors in droplets of water. Now, we've been talking about water. Are there other liquids that that you're studying as well?
So we have also observed this effect in oil droplets in water. These oil droplets actually have to have two different types of oil in a single droplet so that there's an interface between the oils. This effect does not happen if you have a perfectly spherical droplet. There has to be some sort of broken symmetry, like a hemispherical shape in there somewhere. So we use multi-phase droplets and we see the same effect.
Lauren, does the liquid generate the color or is it revealing color that's already there?
What it's actually doing is taking the white light that's shining on the droplets, and it's causing some of those wavelengths to either constructively or destructively interfere. So it's basically taking parts of the visible spectrum out of the white light that you're shining onto the droplet.
Your research seems to involve everyday materials, maybe looking at them differently, maybe asking different questions.
Yes. I mean, when we first noticed these colors just in simple water droplets condensed onto, you know, transparent plastics, it was so simple. And we spent a long time wondering why nobody had mentioned this before in the literature, why nobody had described this effect. And the best thing that we could come up with was that it is so common and people see it presumably every day that they just sort of pass it off as an effect that's already been described. For instance, the way that a rainbow is produced or diffraction, for instance. So it's really surprising to me that something that is so rather ubiquitous and so easy to produce has gone undescribed for this long. But now that we know it and we know how to harness it, I'm pretty excited to see what we can do with it.
What are possible practical applications of this research?
So it's a way of producing these iridescent colors with micro-scale features, which might open up new opportunities for both the fabrication and design of materials, for instance, paints or, you know, coatings, wallpapers, et cetera, that have iridescence but which don't require nanoscale control. So I think there are a lot of exciting things you could think to do with it.
Would the paint change in color?
So by virtue of the fact that this is a structural color, there is the iridescence property to it. So it is angle dependent, but in the way it exists right now, it is iridescent. So you would see different colors from different angles.
So if I walked into a room and saw the paint on the wall from the angle, it might look like one thing, and then looking straight on, it might look a little bit different?
That's possible. So it would have that iridescent effect to it. I guess the thing that comes to my mind is car paints, where some people have those fancy car paints where you see the car from different angles and it changes hue a little bit. So that's what comes to my mind. So cosmetics would be another, you know, maybe you don't want your walls to change different colors, but cosmetics, nail polish, those kind of things often take advantage of sparkly, iridescent colors and things like that.
My final question is this. So what's the next step in your research?
So in my research lab, we're really interested in these droplets, these multi-phase oil droplets that I mentioned earlier, and how those can be used as sensors.
The sensors would sense what?
So one thing I'm thinking of is potentially for sort of a low-cost, low-power diagnostic platform. For instance, we've already shown that we can sensitize these droplets to enzymes in the water. And enzymes are very important for diagnosing different diseases. Enzymes can be used for amplifying the signal from some, you know, antibody interaction. It can bind to specific molecules or specific viruses or specific bacteria, for instance, in the water. And then enzymes could amplify that response. And then you get this optical readout in the droplet. So I'm imagining sort of a very portable colorimetric sensor that you could tailor the chemistry to make it respond to all sorts of different diagnostic markers that you might want for a point-of-care diagnostic sensor.
Lauren Zarzar is an assistant professor of chemistry at Penn State and a leader of the research team from Penn State and MIT. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, NPR award-winning journalist Melissa Block. She's covered everything from 9/11 in New York to the devastating 2008 China earthquake. Melissa Block on her journalistic approach and the future of NPR. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Mick Stinelli, Julia Zenkovich, and Alex Lenigan. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.